So, it's Oscar season all over again, Chern. Any big stories for you?
Well, apart from that story, I was really interested in the Best Picture nomination, which is Coda. And I think, continuing a theme of looking at movies that A might not have been a big blockbuster of the year, but nonetheless, it being the first movie to look at deaf people and persons with disabilities, I thought that was really interesting and I can't wait to watch it. I haven't seen it. Have you seen it, Sam?
I've not, no, but I share your sentiments completely. And I also noted that it's the first film distributed by an online streaming platform to win Best Picture, which is interesting as well, because I wonder if it's a sign of where we're going.
And luckily for me, it's Apple TV, which I do have. And on that note, it's time to start another streaming service. It is Saturday, the 2nd of April, 2022.
And this is Ballot to Talk About.
Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of Ballot to Talk About. And joining me, as always, from the other side of the globe is my co-host Sam. Hey Sam, it's been a whole week in which you moved 1 hour ahead with the arrival of British summertime. How did that feel?
To be honest, I didn't notice it so much, but it is nice that on an evening we have a lot more light. But I feel like British summertime is a little bit of a stretch because for the last 2 days in London, it's been snowing.
Well, it's only the start of April, so hopefully things will get better. And hopefully it doesn't reach 35 degrees. But that is till then. I thought, Sam, before we start, as we are heading back this time round to the continent of Europe to talk about two elections that we have not really made the news, given what has been happening around the continent. I should note it's been 6 weeks since we last covered the European elections, having done two elections in South Korea, South Australia, and in an Indian regional election. So first of all, it feels weird to be coming back, doesn't it? And what a different Europe it has been, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that must be the longest stretch we've gone without talking about a European election for sure, because they dominate the electoral calendar every year. Well, mainly because there's just so many countries and so many states that we cover, but that is crazy. But you're right, it has been a very different series of European elections, not just the two we're going to talk about today, but just generally over the last 3 to 6 months, and I wonder if those trends will continue.
Well, today we'll be moving on to talk a little bit later about a Labour Party in Malta, this time winning a third consecutive election in a landslide victory. But before that, we thought that we will look at a very good night for another centre-left political party, the Social Democrats, in the tiny German state of Saarland. So, Sam, what happened there?
Yeah, so the Social Democratic Party, the SPD, in Saarland have won an absolute majority with 29 seats when you need 26 seats for a majority, and they increased their share of the vote by 14%. They used to be governing this state in a grand coalition led by the Christian Democrats, but now they'll be going into governing there alone after the Christian Democrats lost 5 seats down to 19, losing over 12% of the vote. So it really was a changing of the guard moment in Saarland in this election. The AfD will be the only other smaller party who is represented in the Legislative Assembly with 3 seats on 5.7% of the vote. And then the Greens, the FDP, and Die Linke all fell outside of the 5% threshold. Die Linke, in particular, losing 10% of the vote down to 2.6%, which, for a party that has had quite a good showing in Saarland in the last few election cycles, to have been kicked out of the 5% threshold entirely, I think, is a story in itself. But all in all, Chern, it's been a really good night for the SPD, who, interestingly enough, the last time the SPD won a majority in a state election, do you know when that was?
No, when was that last time?
So not Saarland, it was the city state of Hamburg in 2011. And interestingly enough, do you know who led them into that election?
Oh, I know where this is going. It is Olaf Scholz, isn't it? The now
it
federal chancellor
Olaf
of Germany.
Scholz. Exactly. So he led the SPD to their last election majority in a state election, and is now presiding as the federal chancellor over their most recent time of winning an absolute majority. But I mean, it has been a dire few years for the SPD, really. So to have now two consecutive election results, one at federal level, one at state level, where the SPD have done much better than last time, I think seems to be a step in the right direction for the party. But Chern, an institutional question for you first to get us started. We saw in this election three of the smaller parties in Germany fail to win 5% of the vote. In fact, the Green Party fell 23 votes short of the 5%, getting 4.995%. Question, is the 5% threshold too high?
We're back to this perennial question about the 5% threshold. I think this is a freak set of results. I mean, we've got 77.7% of the voters in Saarland represented through members of parliament here. And we've got the FDP at 4.8%, you know, again, for agonizing close. It reminds me of the 2013 German federal election where it was only four parties, and both the AfD and the FDP failed to get in at the end that time. And what we saw was that it greatly inflated Angela Merkel's numbers, where she got only 41.5% of the vote, but fell only five seats short of winning an absolute majority. I should note that should the Greens get over the 5% threshold, and it's not, whilst I think it's unlikely, I don't think you could discount the possibility in a recount in a state with, yes, it's under a million voters, but potentially, we should note that it would not deprive the Social Democrats of its overall majority. And in any way, the SPD and Greens would be quite happy to govern in a coalition with each other. I personally think that a 5% threshold is still a good threshold to have, because we only have to look to the neighboring state of Netherlands as a good counterexample for when you do not even have a threshold. It took them over 270 days to form a government, and it turned out to be the government of the same stripes as the outgoing one. So I think personally, this is a freak result that I think will revive debate of the 5% threshold, but I still think that 5% threshold is there, considering we live in an era with a fracturing of voters, where voters are moving beyond the major parties and looking for alternatives. Voters do want government to get governing, and just spending over 200 days to form a government is just a frankly awful lot of waste of time. Do you agree with that sentiment?
I completely agree. And I think the important point here is that it is a freak set of results in so many ways, because it's the first SPD majority since 2011. Well, it's the first majority in any Landtag for any party since 2013 in Bavaria. So it's not typical that these kind of results come about. And notably, it will become the only state with just three parties in the legislature. So I think when you're debating this 5% threshold, it's important to note that this is not a typical occurrence in German politics. This is very unusual. And to base an entire debate over whether the 5% threshold is too high on this set of results, I think is ignoring the fact that in most German states, it tends to still produce a representative parliament. And the original purpose of the 5% threshold, even though it's not written into the constitution, but has since been upheld by the constitutional court, is to prevent a freakish fragmentation of seats. And that's not what we get in states where these smaller parties do cross the 5% threshold. But it probably would have happened in this case, because you would have had the left, even though they lost 10% of the vote, getting seats, the Greens and the FDP. And in that case, you're probably going to need to negotiate a coalition of some description, even though the SPD won the election very comfortably.
And I think finally as well to say is that if you look at Saarland itself, it's the first single party government in Saarland since the 1970s. So it's not as if this state does produce a lot of single party government. It's just that this one did. But I think what is interesting in this case in Saarland is that we're really in uncharted territory with them. They've got, and it'll be interesting to see how they govern Saarland over the next couple of years, because even if they do get a majority, I'm pretty sure that it's one-off occurrence rather than something that would continuously happen. Let's kick off our analysis of the various different parties. And I would actually like to start with a party that didn't make it into parliament, because to me, I think this is one of the more interesting stories about this election, which is what happened to the Linke. Where did most of their voters go? It seems that most of their voters would appear to go to Social Democrats. Have they, Sam?
That seems to be what has happened. I've found it quite hard to pinpoint it down, because unlike a lot of US elections, for one case, they don't tend to produce a lot of exit poll data that's not just party preference. So we're not quite sure where these votes have gone, but it does seem to be that whilst the SPD has risen, the left have tumbled, and that would seem like the more natural home for left party voters. And I think also, if you're wanting to look for explanations for what was going on, it seems that there was just a complete breakdown of party unity within the left party that seems to be centered around a dispute between the state chairman, Thomas Lützer, and the parliamentary leader in Saarland of the left, Oscar Lafontaine, who, interestingly enough, was the minister-president of Saarland in 1994, which was the last time that the SPD actually came first in Saarland, when Oscar Lafontaine used to lead the SPD into those elections as well. In summary, Thomas Lützer has been accused by the other side within the party of manipulating internal elections, despite no evidence having been found through public audits, a federal review, and investigation by the State Office for Public Prosecution. So it just seems that within the party there's irreconcilable differences between these two factions. And in fact, Oscar Lafontaine chose not to seek re-election, and the deputy chairwoman was expelled from the party for supporting the attacks of Thomas Lützer on the left faction. So it seems a complete breakdown of any civil relations in the party. And I think, considering that the left are a left-leaning party, it seems most logical to me that the SPD is where their votes went to, if indeed some of the voters who are disenfranchised turned out at all.
Well, just to give you an extent of how far the Linke has fallen, I've got statistics here that show that in 2009, so we're looking at, not too long ago, to be frank, we're looking at three elections ago, they got 21.3% of the vote. And now they have just 2.6% of the vote. So quite a dramatic fall from grace, really. And I think as well that another thing I was reading about why the Linke has potentially, and this is something I think we'll be talking a little bit in snippets throughout the rest of this podcast, and in fact, over the next month as we begin a bumper set of European elections culminating in France in a couple of weeks' time, was the fact that Oscar Lafontaine disagreed with the Linke's actions in the Bundestag over Ukraine. Oscar Lafontaine actually resigned from the Linke as well over after the party supported exporting lethal weapons to Ukraine, something in which we will be discussing in a future episode as well. So we can't ignore that such a huge global event has such a big impact on such a small state election. I think that's very interesting indeed.
No, I'm glad you brought that up, because, yeah, it is interesting how far-reaching these decisions can be. And in terms of these decisions, I think it's a nice opportunity to broaden out a bit to the SPD to talk about where their victory came from. And in addition to asking you, Chern, how do you think the SPD pulled off this election victory, I'm also wondering, do you think it's a reflection of a honeymoon period for the Scholz government on the federal level? Or do you think it is a state level reason for victory?
I think it's a combination of both. I've seen reports that the deputy minister president and now soon to be minister president, Anke Rehlinger, she herself, Anke Rehlinger, was really popular within the electorate of Saarland itself. And I don't think that could be discounted, particularly in one of the smallest German states out of them. And I think, you know, that local factor did help as well to push them over. I should note as well that that the Social Democrats themselves federally, ever since the war in Ukraine and Olaf Scholz 180 degrees on a large aspect of what is seen as the establishment of German defense and foreign policy, decisions that he took has been doing relatively popular in the polls, and I don't think that could be discounted here as well. So I think to me, it's a mixture of both local factors and federal factors as well. I think what to me this sets up is actually not what this result could mean by Saarland, but what could mean for the rest of the elections that are due to be coming up in the next couple of months' time, particularly in North Rhine-Westphalia and Schleswig-Holstein, where both CDU premiers will be up for re-election. And North Rhine-Westphalia is the German state to watch, given it's home to 20% of the population. I remember recalling the 2017 set of results where then CDU premier Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, which is quite a name familiar to German politics over the last couple of years, she was the premier of Saarland. She pulled off a much more impressive victory against against the same SPD candidate, actually, and who was one that was heavily backed in by Martin Schulz. And that was the first time that something was not right with the Social Democrats in 2017, despite the momentum they had at the start of the year. So I think this result in Saarland for the SPD could have something more beyond its borders into the state elections that could be happening moving forward in the next couple of months.
Yeah, I completely agree that I think there's a balance between the state and federal reasons for this. And I think a statistic to look at in terms of the federal reasons for this victory is that the margin of victory of Olaf Scholz is SPD over the CDU in the federal election last year was 15%, which, interestingly enough, is also the margin of victory of the SPD over the CDU this time around as well. So in terms of the party preferences, although the CDU and SPD have both increased their vote share versus the vote share they got statewide in the federal election, the margin of victory between those two parties has broadly stayed the same. So it does seem to me that whatever the preferences were back in the federal election last September, not so much seems to have changed in terms of people's preferences now, in terms of the parties they're choosing to vote for. And it's interesting to note that until the summer of last year, the CDU had been leading very comfortably in opinion polls for Saarland. And it wasn't until that federal election that opinions seemed to change in the SPD's favour. And that has been continued all the way through to the state election. So I agree with you that it'll be more interesting to look at the other states that are coming up this year, because one thing that does happen in German politics and has been known to happen in the aftermath of federal elections or even in the run-up to them is that once one surprising election result comes in, others sometimes follow suit because there's a bit of a chain reaction thing in German state politics, and it'll be fascinating to look at whether that happens this time around as well. And we have three more German state elections to look forward to this year. Schleswig-Holstein, we have Lower Saxony later in the year, and we also have North Rhine-Westphalia as well. So we'll have three indications after this day as to whether this is a honeymoon period for Scholz, a fluke result that is just sitting within his sweet spot, or whether throughout the rest of 2022, we get an indication that the SPD might actually be onto something at the moment.
Well, I think to me, what I think is very interesting is the fact that, you know, Saarland in the 2021 German federal election produced I think we mentioned this on our podcast when we reviewed the German federal election last year, produced one of the most surprising switches really in constituency representation from SPD to CDU. I mean, this is the state, of course, to, apart from Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, who I mentioned, Peter Altmaier as well, the federal economics and energy minister, lost his seat. And three out of the four federal seats, which were CDU, have now changed to become SPD. So the entire of the Saarland representation at a federal level in constituencies is entirely SPD dominated. So I think that late switch has now mirrored itself in a state election. If you go onto Wikipedia, for example, if you compare the results of the 2017 election in terms of regional support within Saarland in 2017 and 2022, it is quite a remarkable sea change. In 2017, the SPD really only got a majority of the vote in two areas of Saarland. Now they have gotten the majority of the vote in every single region of Saarland itself. And that to me is an astonishing change.
No, absolutely. And I wonder if, Churn, if this is a nice point to bring in the sort of discussion that we had when we talked about South Australia, for example, is that you have to put a big, heavy asterisk on these results because in Australia, the difference between state election preferences and federal election preferences can be pretty stark. In Germany, how do you assess what usually happens here? Because to me, one of the big asterisks for this election is more about the fact that the vote, even if the vote is the same, it's unrepresentative because Saarland is a very small state, it's a heavily industrial state, it's an older state, it's one of the most religious states. So in terms of its demographics, it doesn't tend to tell a big story about Germany, the state of opinion in Germany as a whole. But how do we judge this in terms of are the state election results usually representative of federal preferences for that state?
I think it's really hard to say because to the best of my knowledge, particularly towards the end of Angela Merkel's tenure as chancellor, she still won the 2013 election despite losing North Rhine-Westphalia in the 2012 elections, for example. It's the biggest counterpoint to that. I think now that we're so far away from the next federal election, it becomes very difficult to conflate what these results mean to potentially what this result mean for the federal election. Nonetheless, I do think if the timelines were a little bit closer, like the last time we had Saarland in 2017 election lead up to the federal election, I think there were more concrete lessons to be drawn. That, and I remember as well the 2013 Bavarian election, when the Bavarian CSU regained its majority. That was 2 weeks before the federal poll. And I think some of the main, and I think it's very difficult to conflate both the regional election and the federal election then. That being said, I think if I look at these results, I think some of the same trends we're seeing at the federal level are applying to this election in particular. Well, considering when these elections last took place, we have seen a big increase in the Social Democrat vote. We've seen a big decrease in the CDU vote. The AfD have sort of stagnated a little bit, but still maintain a solid level of support from what they had in the previous election. And the Greens and the FDP have both increased their votes, similar to what we've seen in the federal election. So I think in total, particularly given this election so far removed from the next federal elections, it's hard to draw a lot of meaningful conclusions. But I think compared to South Australia, there are some of the same underlying trends we have seen in this election compared to the 2021 federal election.
And sort of as a final discussion on Saarland, what are there any other like federal implications we can draw, or even implications just moving forward to the other state elections coming up later this year?
Well, I think to me, what would be very interesting is that the CDU will be playing defense. It's really lost one out of the three, and with the main prize of North Rhine-Westphalia is the next one up. So I do note, for example, that the new CDU leader, Friedrich Merz, has went to Saarland several times during the campaign. You can probably expect him to appear in North Rhine-Westphalia and Schleswig-Holstein, but I imagine it'll be quite difficult territory. I think from the CDU's perspective, they could be potentially worried about the fact that these are factors that traditionally, highly religious is in West Germany, where the CDU is traditionally stronger. Older voters, I have a statistic here where 50% of those over 60s voted for the centre-left party, which is where you often assume the pensioners and those over 60 as being a firm supporter within the CDU. And so therefore, the loss of such a core group of support, I think, will be quite worrying. So to me, this would I can sort of, I think on one hand, the CDU can say, well, it's a federal government honeymoon, and being a new government has sort of rallied around the incumbent, particularly with a lot of uncertainty over Ukraine. But nonetheless, I think considering the demographics, I don't think it bodes well for North Rhine-Westphalia and the upcoming state elections. What do you think about the CDU? How would they interpret this result?
Yeah, I'm not particularly sure, to be honest, because there was an element of this result that was not particularly surprising in terms of opinion polling. But then for it to be a wider margin than expected for the SPD for now the second time in a row, because let's not forget the federal election last time as well, underestimated how strong the SPD were going to perform. And as you said, North Rhine-Westphalia is a big prize because it's the most populous state in Germany. It also has a large implication on the Bundesrat, which I think is under discussed in a lot of these state election results, because The Bundesrat plays, it doesn't play a significant role in policy making, but it plays a similar sort of role to the UK House of Lords in that it can be quite disruptive if it wants to be. And at the moment, now after the Saarland state election, we have 24 of the 69 votes in the Bundesrat are part of left-leaning governments with no CDU and CSU involvement at all. And any increase on that they could get from North Rhine-Westphalia, from Schleswig-Holstein, or indeed Lower Saxony later in the year, would really help Scholz, particularly if he's wanting to push through quite a radical agenda, which is what he was elected to do. And for people who don't know, in the Bundesrat, the state delegations that are sent, which represent the colours of the state government, have to vote as a block. They can't vote individually. So it's the government's position on these policies. So if you have a grand coalition between the SPD and CDU, they probably wouldn't vote for radical left-leaning policies because they have the CDU in that state also have to agree with it. So if the SPD can get a bigger showing in North Rhine-Westphalia, or indeed have this kind of result in Lower Saxony, where it's currently an SPD-led grand coalition, then if they can get a complete SPD delegation from Lower Saxony into the Bundesrat, that's great news for Olaf Scholz. So I think it's difficult to judge, as you said, but it shouldn't be written off how, for Olaf Scholz, these are very important victories, and Saarland is a step in the right direction.
I think just one final point I wanted to ask you about is climate policy, because climate policy and energy policy will be issues that will be, again, hotly debated in Germany, not always as a big EU player having to walk towards net zero, but clearly energy security is going to be a big question in Germany over the next couple of years. Saarland is, of course, why I look at Saarland, because it's a coal country, as you said, you know, it's heavily industrialized and it is not necessarily a state that is particularly, given its makeup, could be potentially open to some of the policies that Scholz is advocating. Do these results suggest that the gravity of the situation in Ukraine has realized that, yes, these Saarland voters know that they might be enduring some pain as Germany tries to disconnect itself from Russian gas and imports, but it might move into green. How do you see these results impacting German or how voters are feeling about potentially something that will materially impact their lives and their wallets, as many people around Europe are seeing?
I mean, I think it's worth saying that nationally, this is not a Saarland-specific thing, but nationally, the move away from Russian energy dependence has gone down well with voters in Germany. It's going down as a popular policy alongside the decision to increase military spending, which are both quite sensitive topics for German politics in recent history. So it seems to suggest that the gravity of the situation is something that's being understood by German voters. I can't speak for Saarland specifically, which, as you said, would probably be a more interesting thing to talk about because of how industrialized they are. But it does seem to me that these kind of discussions are going down well. But another thing that's interesting, and it's throwing back a bit to our federal election discussion from last year, is that in a lot of these states, the kind of debate that was going on tended to be different across the country in terms of how close the SPD were going to align with Green Party radicalism on the environment. And it seems to me in this election, which is, it's not unusual for the German Greens to fall outside of the threshold in Saarland. In fact, this is now, I think, the second or third consecutive election they've done that. And so therefore, it suggests that maybe in Saarland, this kind of radicalism on climate policy is not as popular as it is everywhere else. But if your question's about the Ukraine response and Russian energy dependence, it does seem to be that on the whole, German voters are on board with that.
So, welcome back to Ballot to Talk About. And we'll be moving on to talk about a country like we haven't talked about, and I'm really excited for this next half of the discussion. It is in the small island nation of Malta, which went for a slightly earlier election last weekend. And the result was that Prime Minister Robert Abila's Labour Party was re-elected for a third consecutive term. In the 65-seat parliament, the Labour Party had 38 seats, which is an increase of one, with winning 55% of the vote, which is roughly the same as what they had in the last election in 2017. And the Nationalist Party, led by Bernard Gregg, has 29 seats, while an increase of one, it's with 41.7% of the vote, down 2%. It is the smaller green, sort of green-affiliated ADPD party, which lost both its seats in the legislature, hence with major parties each picking up one. So, Sam, I think that's where we're going to begin our discussion, because one thing we've talked often about in European politics, and in fact, it was most evident seen in the 2021 German federal election, has been the complete breakdown of the two-party system. That seems to be the opposite here in Malta, where both the Labour Party and the Nationalist Party itself combined got 96% of the vote, which is something I never thought I would really see in any other major European election. So it could be argued that it's them gaining every other seat used to have, that the two-party system has indeed strengthened. So how has Malta proven to be the anomaly compared to the rest of Europe?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key piece of information missing there is the fact that their electoral system, single transferable vote, is meant to be a more representative and more proportional. It's not a purely proportional system, but it's meant to be more proportional than first past the post. And this is even more two-party than a first past the post election, where tactical voting is even more important. When I was looking this up, it seems to be that it has a lot to do with Maltese society and history, because both of these parties, the formation of both of them is heavily rooted in post-independence Malta. And I think they were formed around social cleavages that, of course, have evolved over time, but not dramatically enough to shift the kind of grip that the two-party system has on society. And that's because party engagement is really high, and both of these major parties control huge swathes of media output. Not in the way that that some media output in the US, in the UK, is just tends to be biased towards a particular party or not. This is the party infrastructure have their own radio channels, TV channels, newspapers, so they're able to control the narrative of election campaigns in ways that smaller parties just aren't able to do. And I think that has just meant that the grip that the two-party system has on the country is such that it's not seen as a problem in Malta that it's a two-party system. In fact, it seems to be something that most people seem to be on board with, because they represent the social cleavages that they come from. But that seems to be the big cultural explanation for me. And I think the two-party system is maintained despite the electoral system, not because of it. And there's one more thing I'm going to bring up, which I think has helped why the two-party system has been solidified in recent years, in contemporary Malta. And I think the 1981 election is a big clue to that, because in 1981, the Nationalist Party gained a majority of votes, but the Labour Party gained a majority of seats. And it caused a whole constitutional crisis in which, obviously, because the Labour Party had a majority of seats, the Labour leader, Dom Mintoff, was invited to form a government. But after that moment, it was decided in a constitutional amendment that additional seats would be offered to a party that wins a majority of votes, but not a majority of seats, in order to give it a majority of seats. And I think that decision raised the stakes in terms of the two-party system, and meant that if you don't vote for one of the big two parties to form a government, you're risking the other big party sneaking a majority through this constitutional amendment. And I think that combined with the cultural things that existed before then meant that the two-party system probably is not going anywhere anytime soon. Did you find anything else, Chern?
I think that's a very good explanation, because to me, what is therefore even interesting to me from that perspective, you just listen, is that yes, parties might control traditional media, as you said, their radio and TV as well, but we are in the advent of social media, where it's very harder for major parties to police or get their content out in a way that could be interpreted in the way they want on social media. So I just wanted to make the point that it makes their achievement of them getting 96% of the vote even more impressive in this era of in this era. And it's not as if that Malta has not seen its fair share of scandals and things that could make you disinterested in politics. We're going to be talking about a murder case, and I don't think that is something which we can apply to many countries in a bit. I think where voters are disillusioned, nonetheless, I do see evidence in this election that voters are disillusioned with politics and the political system. Not necessarily by them not voting for the major parties, but them deciding not to even vote it at all. I do note that turnout in this election was 86%, which is comparatively high compared to many other European countries, but that's the lowest turnout in Malta's parliament in ever seen in Malta, and that is a full 6 points down from the 92% that they had in the last election. So I think it's kind of maybe the process of being disengaged with politics just started a lot later because of the institutions and the societies that you had. I think people first expressed their dislike for politics and the current political system by just not bothering to vote at all. And they're waiting for a credible alternative. And because that credible alternative has not emerged, it has been impacted to me in turnout. Because even though there was a 30,000 vote difference, you know, the Labour Party itself lost 8,000 votes, and the Nationalist Party, compared to the last election, lost 12,000 votes. So both major parties have lost pure raw vote share. So I think on the whole, there might not be, but underground, potentially, this is something that politicians in Malta, I believe, should be watching as well.
Yeah, I think there's just a couple of little things to say about turnout, but I think you're absolutely right that this could be the first indication that disengagement with the two parties is emerging. But one of them is that a lot of local commentators dubbed this election as quiet, is what they called it, because they said that the campaign itself was quite uneventful and the result throughout the whole campaign was never really in doubt, which I think such a context makes a reduced turnout not particularly surprising, because just engagement with not the parties, but just the election itself is quite low. And I think it's also worth saying that in addition to just the election seeming to have low stakes, because the whole invasion of Ukraine made this election second tier news, even in Malta where the election was going on, but it was also the first election with an expanded franchise, because this election had 16-year-olds voting, 16 and 17-year-olds voting. And I wonder if turnout amongst the new extended franchise was particularly low as well, which also brought down the overall count. But that's not to undermine your point about it being disengagement with the parties, but I just think it's adding some potential alternative explanations for them as well.
No, I think that's an absolute good qualifier, particularly since we know there's an inverse relationship between as you get older, older voters tend, as you said many times, more likely to vote. So 16-year-olds could represent a very much more low turnout group as well. I should note, Sam, that let's move on to the major parties. This is the third landslide election victory for the new Labour Party leader, Robert Biella, this is his first elected term, who replaced Joseph Muscat as a leader in 2020. So Joseph Muscat, we can't talk about the last term without mentioning one woman who changed Malta's politics potentially and which made worldwide news. Sam, would you like to inform viewers what happened to Daphne Gazila? Because that, I think, has been quite a major story in Maltan politics over the last couple of years, hasn't it?
It has, indeed. And I don't think we've quite still, to this day, got to the bottom of the consequences of this, because they seem a lot more widespread than we see on the surface. So as you said, Daphne Caruana Galizia was a vocal anti-government critic and journalist. And in 2017, I think it was, she was murdered with a car bomb placed inside her car. And the reason this had political implications was because there were a lot of allegations at the time that not only did the government seem to turn a blind eye to this murder, but potentially, right up to the Prime Minister's office, were potentially involved in the murder. Now, it's worth saying that there have been multiple investigations into this, and still there have not been any clear links drawn to the Prime Minister's office, but notably the inquiry in 2019 found that a culture of impunity existed within the government that led to her murderers thinking that they could get away with the murder, which eventually led to a series of protests around Malta that accused Joseph Muscat of impeding the investigation. And he ended up resigning in 2020 over this matter and others. And quite a number of advisers and other parliamentarians ended up having to resign as well over potential involvement in this scandal. So, as you said, it's had a big reach on Maltese politics, which I think makes it all the more surprising that Labour increased its victory in the elections last week, rather than facing any electoral consequences at all, it seemed, for this scandal. So do you think that this scandal itself seemed to be attached to Joseph Muscat, and actually Robert Abela has been able to completely distance the Labour Party from this scandal? What do you think was going on?
I think one more thing to add on the Daphne Gazila case is the fact that the reason why in which she became the target was the fact that prominent Labour politicians, including cabinet ministers, it should be said, and allegations of Prime Minister Joseph Muscat's chief of staff were being named in the then Panama Papers leak. She found their names within the Panama Papers and leaked it. And I think it set off what was a long simmering discontent about the close relationship between big businesses in Malta and the government. And I don't think that could be discounted either. And it just, a whole social movement emerged from that. You're right. It does seem that despite that I think in most countries, it's quite a massive scandal in quite a European countries. It's the results even more spectacular. I think the clue about how the Labour Party has managed to win the landslide victory despite this could be found in who they decided to pick as leader, which is a Robert Abela, as you mentioned. And because prior to his election as leader of the Labour Party, he did not serve in Joseph Muscat's cabinet. In fact, he only joined Parliament itself in relatively recently, in 2017, actually. So he was elected in 2017 and within the same term became its Prime Minister. So I wondered if that set off in many traditionally left-leaning voters that this is a completely new slate of leadership for Malta as well. And that in itself allowed the Malta Party quite a lot of renewal and regeneration that potentially if somebody like Chris Fearn, who was the other leadership contender and was Deputy Prime Minister under Joseph Muscat, if he had assumed the leadership, he would have been too closely associated with the leadership, unlike Robert Abela. So I think to me, that this is one of the only, this is probably one of the key reasons why Robert Abela has been seemingly able to turn it around. I should note as well that I wonder as well, not only the war in Ukraine, but don't forget that this scandal is very much pre-COVID. And I wonder once again, like what we said, as politics has upended COVID, COVID has upended politics in Malta. And I don't think that could be discounted either.
Yeah, and I think it might also come down to the old Bill Clinton edict, which is, it's the economy, stupid, because I think it's worth noting that the Labour Party government, who've been in a majority position since 2013, have recorded quite astonishing economic records, to be honest. Prior to COVID, they completely eliminated the national deficit. Unemployment was at a historic low, and they had a historic period of growth as well. And although that growth was halted by the pandemic, over the last financial year, they've had growth of 9% as well. So the Labour Party are doing something right on the economy, and it seems to be that voters have rewarded them for that as well, because although, as well as increasing their vote share for three consecutive elections since 2013, this is also the second highest seat count that the Labour Party have ever had in Malta since they increased the overall capacity of Parliament to 65 in 1976. So I think, although these corruption allegations and the murder case is profoundly serious, it seems to be that they've managed to shed that reputation through Robert Abela becoming leader and have been able to carry over the positive record in government that the Labour Party had prior to that scandal as well.
I think just a few more statistics that back up, because I think with any centred left party, not only do they demonstrate economic competence, but they also potentially have to demonstrate they are delivering on social issues and, you know, on increasing and on social policy. And I think that this government has done so. It has repeatedly raised pensions. It has been able to freeze energy costs, which is, as we know, energy costs is something that is a big issue in Europe at the moment. Unemployment, of course, known as the economic, can also be seen as a social indicator as well. The party has not raised taxes as well. And you contrast that with the opposition, where its party leader has actually been accused of corruption against Bernard Getch Nationalist Party as well. So I think as well, Robert Abela, he knew what he was getting into when he took over the premiership. It was the Labour Party that was in crisis, social protests as well that were happening in Malta. But crucially, something had to be done about press freedom and the rule of law. And he has also ushered quite a lot of those reforms since he has taken over. You know, he has, at one point, Malta itself was blacklisted by FATF, which is the Global Watchdog on Money Laundering. He has brought in reforms to try and counter claims of that. He has tried to bring in some to strengthen governance and press freedom, although we do know the family of Daphne Gazile has said there's still much more work to be done. So I think he's also tried to plug the weak links in the last government led by Joseph Muscat, and that has helped him as well over the last couple, helping win a landslide victory.
Yeah, and also on social policy, I did note that in December, just gone, it became the first country in the European Union to legalise cannabis as well. Finally, which I think leads us nicely onto the Nationalist Party, because they were particularly unhappy with this decision, but in the days leading up to Election Day itself, the Labour Party government decided that was a brilliant time to issue the subsidy checks that they'd promised on a tax refund and stimulus post-COVID just before polling day, which the Nationalist Party were up in arms about, calling it rank-and-file corruption and scandal. But, I mean, we do see pork barrel politics and election day tax and spend cycles. But this seems to be quite an extreme version of that, doesn't it, Chern? And I understand why the Nationalist Party weren't too happy. But I think in the end, this was the least of their problems.
No, but let's be honest, Sam, we've covered elections all around the world. This is something that every government, incumbent government seeking to win, I think particularly as government ages as well, that these kind of policy decisions become more attractive in their attempts to win another term. So frankly, I think that behavior has not surprised me whatsoever. So Sam, I think one thing we like to do is that we like to compare elections. We've had one election in Malta where the Labour Party and the centre-left have done well. And, you know, in the SPD, it seems Olaf Scholz's honeymoon is still continuing over. So I know we talked about this before, but I saw it in a few of more excited commentary largely online that talked about further evidence of a centre-left revival. And it's clear that the centre-left had a good night in both Malta and in Saarland as well. Do you think that our analysis from a couple of months ago, where it was very much the selection of countries we chose and the circumstances that why the centre-left were back in power at that stage, that it still holds in with these set of election results?
I think it largely does hold, because I think the Saarland example in particular, because when we were talking about centre-left revival across Europe, one of the big asterisks we placed was on Germany, because the SPD have returned to government in Germany, but we did talk about how the federal election result last year was not a resounding return to SPD prominence, and we wanted to see what would happen next and whether it had a lot more to do with Angela Merkel's departure and just circumstantial. But the Saarland election does seem to be a clue that the SPD revival was not limited to that one cycle and is something they might be able to carry forward. And it goes without saying that the Malta election result is a resounding win for the centre-left, but it's the third consecutive resounding win in a row for the centre-left in Malta. So I wouldn't call that a revival per se, because it's something that has been going on now for nearly a decade. But I think it does contribute to this wider narrative of centre-left success. One comparison I did want to make, which I think is interesting between these two countries, is I think they're both examples of a centre-right opposition still trying to find a new identity. In the CDU case in Germany, that's still trying to find what they look like in the post-Merkel era, because she was leader of that party for nearly 20 years and defined the CDU in her own image, in her own ideology. And in the post-Merkel era, they've tried Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, which didn't even make it to an election. They tried Armin Laschet, who was resoundingly defeated in the CDU's worst performance ever. And now they've gone into the Friedrich Merz, who is a completely different ideological approach to Angela Merkel. In fact, they were long-term rivals ideologically in terms of where the CDU needs to turn. And then in Malta's case, I think you have a nationalist party who, prior to 2013, were extremely successful. They came off the back of 15 straight years in majority government between 1998 and 2013. But now they're trying to find what their identity looks like in this new opposition world, where they're battling between traditional ideology, or whether they want to merge with more centrist parties, whether they want to go down more the liberal route. So I think in both cases, they're an example of centre-right parties trying to find an identity. And while this is going on, obviously it's the centre-left who benefits, because when there's divisions, when there's uncertainty over their ideological position, and when, frankly, there's not particularly much interesting policy output from the opposition, it's the centre-left who tend to benefit. But that's where my comparison mainly came from. I don't know if you have any more comparisons, Chern.
Well, actually, if you look up to the time in which the Labour Party came into power in 2013, the Nationalist Party actually won more elections than the Labour Party. And it's now heading into its longest period in opposition. It's three successive elections it's failed to win since the late 70s, since they shut out of power throughout the 1970s. So this is something in which it's something that is a bit unique. I think the only caveat to that is that the Labour Party, the Nationalist Party in Malta, have been out of power since 2013, so we're at 9 years and counting, whereas the CDU has only just been out of power and therefore just trying to find its feet. I think that is much more evident here. I think what is happening in this case is that I wonder if they sense an opening with Joseph Muscat's resignation and the way in which that resignation occurred, you know, in very much under a cloud. We should note that post him resigning the prime ministership, there was also a further scandal involving Joseph Muscat and who paid over a trip to when he went to the Middle East, which again didn't reinforce this idea of a close, cozy relationship between business and politicians. I think what happened is that they failed to readjust to what a post Joseph Muscat led Labour Party, particularly when its leader is one that really had very little ties to Joseph Muscat as well. And I don't think they managed to successfully pivot to that. We do note as well that the campaign, Robert Abila's campaign, whilst quiet, he did pinpoint on environmental issues as one of the big campaign themes. And this is something that is particularly poignant in Malta, where overbuilding and overdevelopment, fueled by, I suspect, a close relationship between property developers and the government, caused a big strain on society. And so therefore, Robert Abila's standing on environmental issues could be helping. And I don't think the Nationalist Party had a convincing enough message to combat what is essentially a new Labour Party. I think this is also sort of seen in the UK as well, where the Conservative government in the UK has been in power since 2010. Hard to believe, many people would say, but every time they've had a change of leader, they've been able to reinvent themselves and the government. And I don't think the opposition in this case reinvented itself to Joseph Muscat leaving. And at this stage, and so I think at various stages, it's a warning for the CDU that they have to react to Olaf Scholz, or they could be out of power for a very long period of time. What do you think of that analysis, Sam?
No, I completely agree. And I think, I mean, it's worth saying that the situation for the nationalists could potentially be far more dire than the situation for the CDU. But nonetheless, I thought it was interesting that we have two centre-right parties here who are battling with where they want to go ideologically. And to end, Chern, because you brought it up there, I think a word, thoughts must go out to Robert Abela, because he took over as Prime Minister in January of 2020, and I don't think he had any idea of what was about to hit him within his first 2 months in office as Prime Minister, and yet he has still managed to be able to campaign not just on COVID record, but on future planning as well, and on climate policy, on tax and spend. And I think given that he only had two months to get his feet under the table as Prime Minister before the COVID pandemic completely upended his entire life, probably, and his entire country's life as well, I think is even more of an achievement.
Well, two final points to end on. And two final points. One is a fun fact. I didn't realize, but Robert Abela's ex-bodybuilder, actually, in the 90s. So I have heard of interesting career transitions, but this is definitely one of them. And secondly, yes, these are two election results, but I think, Sam, we're heading to France, we're heading to Hungary, we're heading to Serbia. I think the narrative will be very different once the month is out, isn't it, about the centre-left performance?
Yes, I think it probably will be.
Well, to find out whether that happens, do stay tuned. But for now, that is it for the latest episode of Ballot to Talk About. Do join us again next week when we're heading to Eastern Europe in our European month to talk about elections in Hungary and Serbia. And as always, we will continue to bring you up to date on the world of politics and elections from around the world. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at @ballot_talk. And please do leave us a rating or review, or simply tell your friends about us. My name is Chen Han, and until next time, we will speak to you soon.